This Week in Palestine offers news, information, and culture from Palestinian perspectives. The following hour may contain views that do not necessarily reflect those of WCBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. Good morning. If you are tuning in to WZBC Radio, welcome. And greetings to all of our podcast listeners. I'll be your host this morning. I'm Sophia Rose Wollman. Welcome to This Week in Palestine. Today we'll have part two of a recent program held at the Community Church of Boston earlier in March of this year, which was co-sponsored by a number of organizations. This panel discusses the on-the-ground realities in Gaza and the West Bank with a focus on the destruction of healthcare systems. The first speaker that we'll hear from is Dr. Othman Mohammed. He is a child and adolescent psychiatrist, also an adult psychiatrist. He is an expert on mental health in Gaza and is a diaspora Palestinian.
So I am a psychiatrist by trade. So I deal with a lot of feelings, mostly every day. And so I think everyone's feelings have been all over the place the past couple of years, you know, since October 2023, but before that as well. And, you know, as a Palestinian diaspora, you know, the checking about feelings has been part of our existence since I was born. So I was born as a refugee in Beirut, in Lebanon, as a stateless refugee in Lebanon. You're not allowed to have a Lebanese citizenship. They give you a little brown piece of paper that you can use for travel. It's called the travel document, which confused most airports in the world. They just, what is this? It used to be handwritten. Now it's electronic, but it was a big ordeal. And then the conversation we had at home when I was a kid is there will be a pathway to go back. We just don't know how yet. And our lives were thought of as a sequence of events that eventually will inch us a little closer to our land. That's a narrative we lived with as children. So part of my life journey was to leave Lebanon, Beirut, and find a way to go back to Palestine. So I popped up in the U.S. and so I'm now a U.S. citizen. So hopefully that can get me back to Palestine. I've never been to Palestine ever. So that's the hope, is one day we'll be able to at least go visit, and let alone return, maybe. My work with the Gaza ordeal has been part of my identity as a Palestinian, of course. But I also have family in Gaza who recently evacuated. I also, back in 2014, assembled with a group of activists and decided to start a social media campaign around the trauma in Gaza to support people. It's still on Instagram and on Facebook. It's called Bissalami. And it was good. We talked about trauma modules. It's on YouTube. You can listen to it. And every cycle of violence, I would push the content and recreate it and revamp it. But this time around, I was stuck. I wasn't able to push content or circulate it because I felt that this is not a solution or an answer or really anything. And the reason is we don't know what to do in genocide. I know what to do for trauma. I know how to work around nightmares and PTSD and help kids who are bedwetting. But what do you do for genocide? We don't have a lot of data about how to do with that. And then, would it be even possible to heal from genocide? What would that look like, even to heal from genocide? And is that healing, right? And the words of famous psychologist Winnicott, who coined the term good enough mothering, a good enough mother. There is no perfect mother, right? But good enough that a mother who cares and pampers and hugs and, yes, sometimes yells, and but gives food and warmth and love, right? Good enough mothering. I wonder what is good enough healing from genocide. And I think this is what we're all kind of working on and discovering. It's different for everyone how to navigate this journey, but one thing we know for a fact is it will involve a lot of grief, right? And grief, not like in the what's like the Google thing that the stages of grief, denial, and then not that kind of grief, but grief that is intertwined with your soul and personality and being every day. I've changed since the genocide in Gaza as a person. There are things that I don't enjoy as much in life as much anymore. And I've kind of had to ask myself, am I clinically depressed? You should know, you're a psychiatrist. You should know if you're depressed or not. And it's okay to be depressed, but I came to the conclusion that this is not just it's not just like quote unquote depression. This is you've been changed by genocide. And I've learned to be okay with that and to celebrate whatever I can celebrate and enjoy life as a Palestinian. Because as Palestinians, we are alive and they cannot erase us. And this is what this genocide showed us, right? And to quote the words of Mahmoud Darwish, the one and only, the famous Palestinian poet, the seeds of a dying spike of grain will fill the veil of wheat. So we are, filling the veil of wheat as Palestinians. Wherever we go, we speak about Palestine, we feed people maklube and msakhan, if you've had those. And we're everywhere in the world. And in the US, we're speaking about Palestine and raising our voices. But today I'll be focusing a little bit about the children of Gaza, the children's mental health in Gaza, so we can share some thoughts together. So this is what typically happens when you have a disaster situation that is not a genocide or an occupation. We have two things happening to the Palestinians in Gaza and in the West Bank now. We have not just a genocide, but one that is perpetrated by an occupation. That's a little different just a genocide or just an occupation. Typically, when you have a disaster, you have a pre-disaster baseline, and then you have the impact of the disaster. So if you're talking about like a hurricane or a war that subsides and goes away, or an earthquake, think about those kind of things. Then you have a honeymoon where there's more cohesion for the community. And then there's a phase that you call disillusionment. And then you slowly wake up and you come to terms with the grief, loss of spaces, loss of memories, loss of people. And then you have a reconstruction, new beginning. If you try to apply that to the Palestinian cause in Gaza and the West Bank, you will be quickly faced with a challenge. What is our baseline? We don't have a baseline that we can say, oh, now we're back to normal. Great, right? So, this is why the classical concepts in psychology many times don't apply to us as Palestinians, in Gaza or otherwise. Why? Because the definition of resilience, for example, in psychology, is that you're able to bounce back to where you were before the incident happened. But where we were starting with is not a great place in the first place. So it doesn't really apply as much. So this is why Western research about mental health and constructs like PTSD, for example, or complex PTSD, are not very accurate, specific descriptions of what is happening here. It might be something else. So this is why, a lot of scholars, including Palestinian scholars like Dr. Samah Jaber, who's used to be the head of the mental health department in the Palestinian Authority, when she was asked about the rates of PTSD and trauma and depression in the West Bank and Gaza, which, as my colleague said, were astronomical, she questioned those numbers. And she said, I think they're measuring social psychological pain and suffering. And they're saying this is depression. What is sick? The context or the person? In Palestine, we see many people whose symptoms, unusual emotional reaction or behaviors are a normal reaction to a pathogenic context. There is no post in the PTSD because the trauma is repetitive and ongoing and continuous. In the words of the one and only France Fanon, if it is society that is sick, then it is society that needs to be replaced. Another famous quote here, if we call it residential school syndrome, and this is referring to the indigenous Americans, we're still labeling that person pathological rather than the process pathological. Why don't we call it a genocide response? That's a better term to use, a genocide response. So as we are always asked, in the Gaza Mental Health Foundation, mental health program, what should we do to help people in Gaza as mental health clinicians? I think addressing these faulty names of disorders would be a place to start. And taking that to public discourse and academic circles and changing the labels and calling things what they are, a genocide response is a better term than PTSD. Another model that is better than PTSD, The Wounds Inside by Rita Jacquemin, who's a Palestinian scholar, referring to how we conceptualize mental health and centering the political determinants of health, which is not talked about as much, but in our case, it's a central circle that really has to be shined on and addressed. And to put things back in perspective, Gaza is mostly refugees, 70%. And what that translates to is that these people have a similar narrative about where they live and what their hope is for the future. The hope is return. In the aftermath of October 7th, I was watching some of the videos that came out. And on October 7th, there are a lot of videos that came from Gaza. One stuck in my head for a reason. There was chaos, and people from Gaza just left the cage and they were just wandering around. And one man was sobbing, crying, just an average man was sobbing, crying. And he was saying, our land. This is our land, Bir Sabah. This is our land. These are our villages. And we're crying and sobbing tears. He wasn't carrying a weapon or a stick or nothing. He just missed his land. And he was weeping over that. So people live with that. And then it's an ongoing cycle of being a refugee because now the refugee has resettled to another refugee camp in a tent, somewhere else. So in a sense, this is a re-traumatization, but also in a sense, this is concentrating resilience. It's concentrating the idea that even that building we lived in the refugee camp in Gaza, is also temporary. That even whatever they built for us is temporary. And the goal is to cross that cage and go back to our land. So some data about mental health in Gaza and the West Bank, and you can read those numbers, but I want to highlight the one in the yellow box. This was a study that was done in the West Bank looking at suicidal ideations and suicide attempts. Not just the thoughts, but like to try to hurt yourself with the hope of dying. And these are studies that this study was done in high school. And the results showed that 25% roughly had suicide ideations, and 25% had suicide attempts. One in every four high school students had tried to hurt themselves. And males were more at risk than females in this study. Typically, in the Western construct, you don't have that high of a rate. And usually, females have more attempts than males, and males tend to have more dramatic and serious attempts than females. That's Western data. But in this study, males were more at a high risk. And if you read between the lines, you understand what happens in the West Bank. Roughly about 40 or 50% of all males in the West Bank who are old teenagers, young men, they've been arrested and contained or dealt with the legal system in the Israeli prisons. So you talk about dehumanization, torture, they see it, they know it's coming. So it's part of the male Palestinian experience. As you become of age, you know that this is 50% gonna be my fate. So that could explain one of the reasons. This is just showing how things were before the genocide in Gaza, and things were not great. There is a big deficit in psychopharmacology, medications used for psychiatric patients, and then maintaining the clinical skill set for clinicians in Gaza by training them from Western-trained trainers isn't always successful or feasible, or even sometimes if not very logical, because the same modalities that we do here, like breath work or relaxation or yoga, might not apply to the Palestinian context in Gaza. I saw an image of a video of a woman in Gaza, surrounded by the shrouds, but of her dead children, and people were weeping and wailing, and then it popped up in her head to recite the verse in the Quran that says, the meaning of which is that the prophets and the honored ones who follow the footsteps of the prophets, whenever they're hit with a calamity, they stand steadfast and they fight back. And that calmed the crowd who was wailing. So spirituality is a big part of healing and coping for the Palestinians in Gaza. And the Western-trained psychologist, a clinician, doesn't necessarily have that lens all the time. So we know the data. These are just estimates. We will find out more. We'll probably get more numbers, unfortunately. But 90% of children are now displaced, many multiple times. And if you look in the back, there's a report from the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. There are reports in the back on the table. You can scan it, you can read it. But it has stories about those displacements. There's a story of Ala, who is a 7-year-old boy, who was severely injured and burned from a strike. And then he was displaced to an Orwa school with his family. And the Orwa school was bombed with the Israeli bombs. And he lost all his family, and then he went to Shifa Hospital. And Shifa Hospital was raided, and he had to evacuate while sick with other patients and walk, quote unquote, the last mile, called the last mile. And then he got to be in a tent with no one in his family. So these are like the stories of this. When we say this multiple times displaced, this is what this means, right? And then we talked about 1% of children are amputees now in Gaza. So big need, and it's getting worse. Some of the active groups on the ground doing mental health work, UNRWA, WHO, GCMHP, ANERA, and I'll mention some of those very briefly. So the WHO gave a lot of meds and did a lot of mental health, psychosocial support. UNRWA, one of the biggest on the ground, despite all the bombings on the schools in Orwa and trying to ban Orwa, they're still doing great work and housing most of people who are displaced internally at the schools. This is the Gaza Community Mental Health Program doing great work, giving psychological first aid, stress management, and then specialized mental health care. Specialized mental health care is these are the folks, the patients who are really not doing well at all. So someone who's getting psychotic, or someone who can't take care of themselves, someone who needs more intervention. So what are some recommended actions to put things, in a practical term? So Gaza is still predominantly food insecure. And I think one of the major things we can help Gaza with is to make Gaza mainstream in our communities. I'd like to see different stores having donation boxes for Gaza. Wherever you go, you see Gaza. Stickers where you can scan the barcode and donate money for Gaza. You can do that in Cambridge. You can do that in Boston. You can do it anywhere. You can talk to NARA, ask them permission to get the barcode, so people can actually start visibly seeing Gaza everywhere they go. And of course, in your local community, your church, you can do a food drive, you can get vitamins, and then send missions to collect and publish stories of torture for the prisoners, the hostages who were released from Israeli jails and prisons. And I'm not going to tell the details of this, the torture stories, because they're horrific, including rape. And then you can do toy drives for kids in Gaza. Those are easy to make, and that also would pull more community support and love and solidarity. Heal Palestine, PCRF doing great work. And then I'm shamelessly put a plug here for the Gaza Mental Health Foundation. Yeah, Nancy here. And if you have any questions about the Gaza Mental Health Foundation, let us know. Another great organization to support and donate money to. With that, I'll stop here. Thank you.
This morning on This Week in Palestine, we're visiting with part two of a recent panel at the Community Church of Boston, which took place in early March of 2025 and was co-sponsored by a number of local organizations. The topic is on the destruction of healthcare in Gaza and the West Bank. Next on the panel is Dr. Karama Hawash Kumerle, a pediatric neurologist in Boston, and one of the core organizers with Doctors Against Genocide.
So I just wanted to say a few things, and then people will have questions. So I want to thank MAPA for holding the space for us here to experience the testimonies from all the doctors, to experience the courage and the resistance, and to be able to arise for justice together. I'm a Palestinian, and I'm also a doctor. I'm a pediatric neurologist, and I am against genocide, and I'm against injustice. And I speak from a deep space of grief and rage, a lot of rage, because that is the natural emotional reaction to what is happening. For the past year, I watched my colleagues in Palestine, the people who are trained to heal, become the target of systematic extermination. The hospitals turned into graveyards, and the patients burned alive in their beds, and children shot in the head by snipers. I work with Bram in the refugee camps, and Rasmi is a personal friend of mine, and he was shot, killed by an Israeli sniper even before all that is happening. And I think this genocide has been ongoing for a century. It just ebbs and flows. And we have seen a massively destructive chapter in the genocide, and it has not ended. Let's not think that the ceasefire ended the genocide. It really did not. And yet, through all these stories that we hear, there is one thread that emerges. It's the courage to care. And thank you for all of you for having the courage to care, because we are being intimidated and we are being silenced and censored, and we are threatened with our jobs and with our livelihood so that we do not care and we do not speak up. So I thank you from the bottom of my heart. It is not easy to be here, and you are brave to care. Thank you. And now we are seeing that the war and the attack on health is spreading from Palestine to us here in Turtle Island. We are seeing a war on health in different forms. Medicaid is gutted, hospitals are closing, and medical care is denied, and research is defunded. Healthcare is being stripped away from those who need it most. The communities of color, the poor, the disabled, the LGBT communities, and That all that while corporate greed turns suffering into profit. And one important thing that I really urge you to do, we are in Boston. We have some of the best hospitals in the world. And who sits on the table making decisions in these hospitals? On the board of Mass General Hospital, MGB, sits one board member who happens to be the CEO of Lockheed Martin, James Taiclet. He leads one of the largest weapon manufacturers in the world, and he earns $22 million per year. Why is he at Mass General? The man that profits off the bombs that flatten hospitals in Gaza has a say in how our hospitals operate here. The same hand that fuels war and destruction holds the purse strength of our healthcare institutions. This is not just a conflict of interest, it's a fundamental moral failure. Please sign our petition from Doctors Against Genocide. We want to remove this board member from Mass General Hospital. Our institutions have failed us, our societies have failed us, our associations have failed us. We have to create our own institutions, our own communities that are just and that are moral. So we refuse to be bystanders and we will be upstanders together. And we will continue to hold sick from genocide clinics and pop-up clinics called Kamal Adwan Hospital, where medical professionals and community members meet together to talk about their feelings and support each other. The only cure for being sick from genocide is to end the genocide. And we end the genocide by organizing, pushing back, speaking truth to power, and not letting people like Takeleth make all this money while he is sending weapons to kill children. So please join us, healthcare workers for Palestine, Doctors Against Genocide. We are working together on these campaigns, Sick from Genocide. And the other campaign is Not Another Child, Not Another Hospital. And that is sent to all the CEOs, the health leaders of health throughout the country here in the United States. So we refuse to be silent. We pressure our government and we replace it if it does not work. And we expose the ties between the war profiteers and healthcare institutions. And we at Doctors Against Genocide, we have meetings with our representatives, our senators, our congressmen, and we talk about this particular issue that health should be just and moral, and we should not send our tax dollars to kill people in Gaza and Palestine. So, if you are ever interested in experiencing civic duties, like people say it here, and you want to come with us to Washington, D.C. We go as a healthcare coalition together and we have meetings and we have asks and demands. We also have a petition that I urge you to sign. Thank you, Bram. Thank you, Dr. Uthman and Thaer, for being here. It's always inspiring to hear you speak because this is real medicine. Thank you.
I am going to introduce Judy Anler to speak for the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine.
I think at the outset, the most important thing for me to say on behalf of the Alliance, a reason that I feel I'm here, is to take all of the information that people, everyone on the panel has given us today, so that the Alliance can do, to quote different people from the panel, to elevate it, to speak truth to power. And that's our work, and our work is to figure out how do we do that. And we work with other activist organizations locally. So one thing is I want to say, had genocide been a legal concept in 1887, that is exactly when Zionism committed its first two acts. When Chaim Weizmann said that they had to appropriate the land of, to appropriate the land of Palestine for Western European Jews, Zionists must eliminate the Palestinian population from the land. And to do this, Zionists must take control of every source of water from the river to the sea and beyond. And he sent a cartographer to begin work to do this. The alliance began in 2013 when Palestinian rights activists came together with several other organizations, including MAPA and the Jewish Voice for Peace, to stop the Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick's campaign to establish the innovative partnership between McCarroll and Massachusetts. McCarroll is a state agency of Israel that has been the machine that has driven Israel's water apartheid policies for decades and still does. That water partnership then would have further cemented Israel and Massachusetts' relationship. The funding would have been used for research and for infrastructure, and both Israel and Massachusetts would have profited from them. It would have greenwashed the truth and continued to redirect and destroy Palestinian water sources. We stopped the partnership. But in the last 20 years, certainly new challenges that are consequences of Israel's water apartheid policies have exacerbated, and that's what we're dealing with today. For the campaign in 2013, the Alliance stood out on the State House. We met with legislators, sent hundreds of postcards that we collected statewide, and even wrote a letter to Governor Patrick when he appeared on a public radio from a West Bank teenager who basically said in his letter, told the governor to stop killing Palestinians, to stop stealing our water. From that campaign on, the Alliance undertook an agenda that calls out and challenges Israel's 100-year regime of water apartheid policies. When this is maintained by settlers, it is maintained by the IDF, and it is maintained by the Israeli government. What I just want to briefly say in the last minute is that our next event is going to be World Water Day on Saturday, March 22nd in Downtown Crossing. You can go to our website, and I also want to encourage people to use all of our social media. Thank you.
You're listening to This Week in Palestine. Today, we're featuring portions of a program hosted at the Community Church of Boston. We've heard so far this morning from Dr. Othman Mohammed, a child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist. We've heard from Dr. Karama Hawash Kumerli, who is a pediatric neurologist and core organizer with Doctors Against Genocide. And we just heard from Judy Anler of the Alliance for Water Justice. We'll now turn to the Q&A portion of this program, which was hosted at the Community Church of Boston in early March 2025.
How do things get to Gaza? How do things get to Gaza when you donate?
Short answer is with difficulty, with great difficulty. Yeah, so there are organizations, US-based organizations, so you can donate to these U.S.-based organizations, and these, like ANERA, for example, NORWA, they have different branches, different parts of the world. So essentially, they can mobilize money that way. But all these organizations, when they send money to Gaza, you have to vet, you know, who's giving you the money and where the money is going to. An extremely excruciating process. And then And now it's been more difficult now because the banks in Gaza have been destroyed. So it is very difficult to find the local bank to send the money to if you want to send money. But it's very difficult. But you know, if you are giving money to a reputable organization, then rest assured it's going to Gaza, but it's going to be difficult. So be generous with the administrative donation. If they say give 10% to cover the admin fees, know that it is really a challenge and those admin fees are really important. But it gets there.
Do you have advice for American mental health care professionals with clients struggling with issues such as moral injury or vicarious trauma or survivor's guilt related to the genocide?
So I can tell you, I've never in my career, and I've been doing this for a minute, being a child psychiatrist, adult psychiatrist, never have I seen kids from white families come to me upset, agitated about the political environment in Gaza. But this year, I see kids come to see me like upset, agitated, and the parents trying to calm them down. Like, tell him something to calm him down because he's always angry about Gaza. Well, good job. That's my first thought. Good job. I think as one of my mentors used to say, you know, anger is an initial feeling and a very superficial feeling. But when you feel anger, that means that you're onto something. So you got to see what's beyond that. Are you angry because your family doesn't hear you? Are you angry because you're lonely? Are you angry because you feel helpless? You got to unpack the feeling to figure out how to help people. If you're lonely, and I get that a lot from people who come to see me who feel lonely, like I'm the only one in the family. Well, find your tribe. Reach out. See who's being active in the community. Speak up. So I guess you have to unpack kind of what's going on to help these people.
Why are Palestinians not considered human enough by the West? There was no restriction from the American and European powers to stop Israel's genocide.
The dehumanization, right, the anti-Palestinian racism, you know, it's deeply embedded. There's many like reasons for it in the West. But I think, you know, part of it was, part of the story, right, is I think what I was getting at with these histories, right, of colonization, right? The histories of colonization and racialization go hand in hand, right? And dehumanizing people by putting them within a racial hierarchy, right, and essentializing them as other, as different, as inferior, is a way to rationalize colonial modes of domination, right? Whether for exploitation, right, and exploitation of labor in particular, or elimination, right, to be able to expropriate their land. And so what we see with the dehumanization of Palestinians is the same, or, you know, similar in many respects to dehumanization of indigenous peoples, right, Black folks, the world over. And in contexts like the United States that are dominated still by settler institutions and settler populations, white supremacy, white settler supremacy and patriarchy, that dehumanization comes very naturally, right? Because they've naturalized and normalized their own control and domination within these societies and these forms of oppression. And so, you know, when we take delegations and have taken delegations to Palestine, right? It takes no time at all for Black folks and Native folks, in my experience, to recognize what they're seeing when they go to Hebron, for example, in the West Bank. You know, also Irish folks, frankly, even as you know, people who became racialized ultimately as white, certainly in these in contexts of like North America. White people struggle, in my experience, a lot more, and it takes them more time to kind of figure out. They're like, wait a minute, but this can't actually be what's happening here, right? You can't actually have two different streets for two peoples, or like Palestinians have to walk on this road while Jewish Israelis can drive, because they don't have that experience, right? They've sort of developed sort of liberal friendly narratives of ultimately, even when they're sort of progressive within you know, contexts like the United States, and have not sort of fully grappled with these kind of historical and ongoing realities. And so what's happening obviously in Palestine and, you know, US support for Israel, I think is very tied up in these dynamics, right? And in Israel ultimately too, you know, there's a lot of focus sometimes on questions of lobbying, right, within the United States. But ultimately, you know, the United States not doing anything it doesn't want to do. Israel serves purposes, and it's been willing to serve these purposes for imperial powers, whether Britain, right, or now the United States, right? So, you know, they've engaged and led dirty, you know, work and counter-revolutionary work in Latin America and all over at the behest of the United States, right? So I think it's important to understand that it's not a question of why hasn't Western Europe or the United States stood up and said something, right? This is part of the ongoing imperial project that those countries are still very much benefiting from, right, and extracting wealth from the rest of the world out of. And so I think that shift in frame then helps us understand the broader struggle for many different peoples that are necessary in order to also simultaneously liberate Palestine.
There are many children in Gaza who have no family left. Who is taking care of them?
Yeah, that's a tragedy. You know, I think one of the goals for the genocide is to destroy the social fabric and social cohesion of the communities in Gaza, but it is still a strength for that community. So they've been taken into other families to take care of them, the distant relatives, people who are able to get these kids, to take care of them. There was a story that was run, I think a few weeks ago. A man, there was like a bombing on a Norway school, and bodies everywhere, blood everywhere. And this man found a baby crying, took the baby, you know, washed the baby, and then migrated to Rafah. And then when the borders were open, went back to northern Gaza. And he was interviewed on the TV and said, you know, I have this baby who calls me dad now. I don't know whose baby this is. And then the real father saw the video. And then he said, oh, that's my baby. So he found the man, he got his baby back. Right. So, I mean, Palestinians will take care of Palestinians. We'll take care of each other. We'll love each other. You know, we love the babies. We love kids. Gaza is predominantly children, right? We celebrate childhood. And but that's how these kids are being taken care of.
How can healthcare leadership in the U.S. be encouraged to acknowledge and address the realities of the situation in Palestine?
So, like Dr. Karama said about MGH, the same applies for many other U.S. organizations. An uphill battle. You know, I used to be a member of the American Psychiatric Association, and the conversation that were had on different caucuses, on different groups, is just mind-blowing that these are psychiatrists who take care of people's feelings. So, and this is not just in psychiatry. The American Medical Association did not take a brave stance against the genocide in Gaza, for example. I used to be a long-term student of and a trainee and a fellow and a graduate of the Boston Psychoanalytic Society Institute, used to be on Beacon here. And they've been vocal about, you know, the current administration and the discrepancies in health and psychological well-being, did not say a word about Gaza. So I think the work that Karama is doing and Doctors Against Genocide is phenomenal. So I think we have to join forces and be more vocal.
I think local acts of courage, building, you know, a movement, it's the only way to do it. I mean, I think the example of, right, the board member and Lockheed Martin says it all, right, in terms of what we're actually up against. And that's probably not, unfortunately, super unique to the Mass General Brigham system. But it means that, you know, we have a lot of power, certainly, for folks who are working within healthcare institutions in terms of, you know, even consideration of things of, like, how we could even withhold our labor and things like that that we haven't really tapped into. But I think if we were really organized, right, you know, you could stop the system, right, in ways that would force a conversation. And so, you know, I think those are things to aspire to.
But there has to be a systematic change. And systematic change can only happen with pressure on policymakers and massive, massive pressure. And I think we are at a point where we should look for our allies in other struggles and continue to work together to really make a different reality for all of us.
Can we hear more about how American medical and mental health associations have reacted to the genocide? Is there any success in getting through to them, or has there been?
So I follow this very closely because we have multiple petitions, and we have seen the American Academy of Pediatrics president. She wrote a letter to Antony Blinken asking for the whereabouts of Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya and asking that Antony Blinken gives a record of what is happening to the healthcare system in Gaza, which is a step in the right direction. She did not call it a genocide. She did not condemn. All she did was an inquiry. Unfortunately, within the American Academy of Pediatrics, there was a massive pushback against her. And there has been an internal memorandum prohibiting members of saying anything about Palestine. And anything on the listservs within the American Academy of Pediatrics that is related to Gaza has been prohibited. And this is to say that these associations and institutions probably are a lost cause by now, and we really need a new, we need to create our own. And I think we are seeing grassroots movements to build a different medical reality that is anti-genocide, that is rooted in justice, and that is very much grassroots. And I think, you know, all of us here will make it happen.
Yeah, I can just say about the American Medical Association as well. There was a lot of reports early on that they were shutting down conversation. And then actually, while there was almost nothing in any of the major medical journals, American medical journals, they commissioned a piece from bioethicist named Matthew Winia that, among other things, argued, and this was back, I think, in like November of 2023, that argued that reasonable people could come to different conclusions about the ethics of bombing children if militants were thought or known to be nearby. And so it just gives you, I think, an indication of, how, I guess, the most powerful medical association in the country is positioned here. And, you know, with regard to academic medical centers, institutions have had multiple talks and panels canceled. And so, you know, this kind of thing is like essentially the norm within, you know, again, these associations, but also the academy.
But then we have this, and we have, you know, this is a very high level academic medical talk and with very good audience and audience online. And I think we have to create our own spaces where we can educate ourselves and others, and they will become the absolute, the official institutions are not doing their jobs. So we are not going to just wait for them to do their job. We will just do their job for them.
Every lawyer who remains silent as international law is undermined is complicit. Every doctor who remains silent as the Hippocratic Oath is violated is complicit. How to expose this hypocrisy?
I think, you know, with the Genocide Convention, there is a duty to report and duty to prevent, and this is on every government that signed up to the Genocide Convention. One thing that we are trying to do is to introduce the medical definition of genocide, which is focused on prevention and detection, just like we look at cancer or diabetes, chronic diseases. We have to identify the signs and the symptoms of the condition in order and diagnose it correctly to be able to treat it. So the medical definition of genocide is looking at the signs and symptoms in any community that can lead to genocide, like dehumanization, racism, segregation, ghettoization, and make it a medical duty to detect these and document them and come up with a diagnosis or a warning. For example, you know, impression pending genocide or impression high, very high risk of genocide, and make it a medical calling for all of us to speak up against it. This sounds like theory, but we are introducing this to the United Nations Right to Health Special Rapporteur and the Special Rapporteur to Human Rights as well. Just like we identify child abuse as a medical condition and we have an obligation to report it, or sexual abuse or bullying or human trafficking, all these are medical emergencies that we have to report as doctors or nurses. Genocide has to be at the same category.
Yeah, and I think what we've learned from the last year and a half, right, regarding complicity of institutions, organizations, right, people are not shameable, actually, in these positions, right? The universities, right, say like Columbia University, they'd rather call in the police to beat their own students than to even have conversations about boycott, for example. But what that does, right, as Karama was saying, right, it creates the space to really grow a movement, because the mask is off, to really expose, being like, these are the, you know, these institutions claim to stand up for these values, right? Columbia will like brag about, you know, its revolutionary students of the late 60s. We know that's now, you know, it couldn't be more obvious that that's BS, right? So that's an opportunity to bring more people into a movement to, you know, a completely alternative nexus of power that is disconnected from those platforms of mainstream power to then do something differently. So I think that's been my big takeaway from the last year and a half, right? Is that would be, you know, it's not to say it's a waste of time. It's just that with the current power structures, what they are and the urgency of this situation, right? You know, there's no one listening.
long-term goals of Palestine, WB attacks similar to Gaza. How can we stop us from being a partner in this genocide?
You know, and someone mentioned before about all the single bullets to the head and chest, right, that were documented. I mean, dozens of cases were documented, right? Even the New York Times published it. But this isn't new, right? During the Great March of Return, right, protests from 2018, you know, there was not even just all these examples of snipers killing medics, killing disabled people, intentionally maiming people, etc. There were entire profiles where they interviewed them and they admitted that that's what they're doing, right? So essentially many of what the violations do is they test out the international waters of what will be allowed in order to escalate that violation, right? So when, you know, Thayer talked about the Shifa hospital, the initial invasions of Shifa in November 2023, right? And then there was the enormous one in April 2024. They destroyed the entire hospital. But that initial one, there was a former State Department advisor, I can't remember exactly his name. He basically said that what I think is happening here is that they're testing to see what would be allowable, right? By if they can attack Shifa, bomb, you know, Shifa, and if nothing happens, right, this will set up a context in which they know they can bomb all the other hospitals. That's exactly what happened, right? And so that, you know, this is overarching sort of context of impunity, right? So, I mean, it's almost impossible for anyone to follow all of the war crimes and crimes against humanity that are happening, right? And essentially they're known, right? And they're even known internally within the State Department. I mean, there were all these reports to Blinken, right, that it came out later that he obviously actively ignored. So I think it helps, I think it just to give that context in order to, again, think about this strategy piece of like, how exactly are we going to, you know, use this knowledge, right? But also understand that certain forms of documentation aren't going to be the answer, right? Because human rights organizations on the ground in Gaza and the West Bank have been documenting this for a long time, including, you know, attacks in the West Bank, right? There were dozens of attacks in the West Bank on healthcare every month in 2022, for example, in 2021, in 2020, in 2019, 2018, every month attacks on healthcare. We wrote a piece. There was a paper in the New England Journal on attacks on healthcare in Syria, I think around 2015. We tried to write a similar one on Palestine. Be like, oh, you guys published this piece on Syria, you know, and this was well before October 7th, this was like 2020. And of course they rejected it. We ended up publishing in some European journal, but you know, dozens. So like all of this on the one hand is known. And so we have to think about, you know, just continue to be strategic about how, you know, what are the levers in which we can ultimately act on that. So
has Israel deliberately not included health care workers in the prisoner releases?
I mean, I know there are still something like 130 from Gaza that are being held. And Hussam, who is, you know, they're discussed, is still being held. He was expected to be released in the sixth exchange, but was not. So I think there have been some who have been released, right, including Yehoda Ser, and there was also the director of Shifa Hospital, who was held for about 9 months and tortured. But that he was released even earlier as part of it. So I don't know if there's a systemic pattern. What we do know, right, is from statistically from the data that healthcare workers have been killed at a higher proportion of compared to the general population, you know, like something like 3% of all Palestinians in Gaza have been killed, and healthcare workers at an even higher, right? So, you know, certainly there have been a huge number of people who have been rounded up, taken to these torture chambers, tortured, sexually assaulted in some cases to death, including Adnan Al-Bersh, the director of orthopedics as well.
This is directed to Dr. Mohammed. How do you see the way forward to start the healing? Does the healing focus on food and shelter, or is it addressing the effects of trauma on the children urgently?
Yeah, the answer is, if you've played with children, right, the child will not play well or play freely if they're hungry. So we need all of the above. You have to feed the children, play with the children. And there are, on the ground right now, a lot of supports for children to, you know, play and sing and and dance. And the question is, how do you protect that? So this is where the political interventions and solutions have to be implemented to push for a longer ceasefire so the kids can play. And the malnutrition now, as the trucks come in more, I think they're helping a little bit. But like I said, even before the genocide, food was not really great in Gaza, and children already had malnutrition. I think studies show before the genocide that about 20% of kids have anemia because of the low iron that they can't access in from their diet in Gaza. So the answer is all of the above, and we hope that the ceasefire still holds so the kids can grow and play.
There is also, you know, the need for being heard and being seen for the people in Gaza. And one thing that we are trying to work is to actually do twin agreements between medical doctors here and medical doctors in Gaza. So, for example, you know, I'm a neurologist. I will connect with a neurologist there, and that will be my peer. Or, you know, even a nurse or even a child, like, you know, having pen pals or having children from here connect with children there. It will make, you know, will create a strong network and strong support that helps us heal from being sick from the genocide, as being, you know, actively involved in the lives and the support of the people there, and also helps them be seen and be heard and have their voices listened to by the whole world. And, you know, we can see a lot of the medical students and a lot of the people in Gaza have accounts, and they tell their stories, and it is healing to be heard. So, you know, any way to connect with the people there will humanize them and will also empower them.
I'm a psychiatry resident at Boston Medical Center. So I'm here representing the Committee of Interns in Residence, which is part of the labor service union for all healthcare workers. We were one of the first union locals to pass resolutions endorsing the boycott, divest, sanction movement and unendorsing politicians who support occupation, genocide, and apartheid. This vote was passed with overwhelming margins, and we represent 260, maybe over 260 unionized physicians across the nation. And it's actually grown because we just got MGB. And yeah, very exciting. We were able to pass this in May of 2024. Since then, it took us a very long time to pass these resolutions, months and months of one-on-one speaking with our union members and also representing the resolutions at convention. We all helped co-author these resolutions. And we were following the demands of the Palestinian General Federation of Trade Unions, as well as the Labor for Palestine National Network, which is here in the United States. And then in this December of 2024, in Alameda County, they did a divestment vote of $32 million from Caterpillar Inc., which has faced criticism for its role in the destruction of Palestinian homes, infrastructure, and agriculture, as well as the U.S. prison industrial complex, border militarization, and immigration detention centers. So some of our labor union members were able to offer testimonies working off the resolutions that we passed. We're hoping to do this kind of work here in Boston as well. So would love to work with you all.
We're out of time for this week's installment of This Week in Palestine. If you have any questions or you'd like to support us in any way, please send us an email at twippodcasts@gmail.com. I would like to thank the team that works behind the scenes to make this show happen. Many thanks to Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Ann Lucas, Muhammad Al-Ghul, Lish Tran, Tahani Abu Mosa, and Stephen Lowe. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WVBC Student Radio at Boston College. As always, we thank you for spending your morning with us as we continue to work for Palestinian liberation. We'll see you next week, and peace.